today talking about Nigo. Nigo is, as you said, a huge topic, and we can't necessarily cover everything. But to get at least a good overview of what the concept entails, especially as a lot of it is rooted in Masechus Ksuvos, and it's also worthwhile to think about what it implies for all of life, because Nigo reflects certain principles of human interaction, and all of halacha is reflective of things that we don't always appreciate, and especially once you get involved in questions of din and questions of how people interact with each other, and especially when you consider the fact that some of the dinim that regulate na'amanus, as we're talking about, sometimes they're rooted in a pasuk, and very often they're not, and yet they still have the power of a daraisa, which means that we're dealing here with svaras that are so powerful, they're so mukhrav, that they impact the Torah law, even though it's not clear directly where they're derived from. So that means that they must tap into something very deep and fundamental about human nature, and that Chazal are teaching us something fascinating. And it's really a unique opportunity to connect to that message that Chazal are giving us, that Chazal are telling us that these principles are so pashut and are so fortified in terms of what they reflect, that they're effective on a level in HaTorah. There's something very, very instructive about that. And on a hashkafic level as well, I think it's worth thinking now as we approach Yom HaDin that there is a lot of overlap between the principles of Din that we are talking about here and the Yom HaDin of Rosh Hashanah, and the kind of arguments, so to speak, that we are making in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we should have another year, that we should hold on to our Chezkas Chaim, and the types of svaras that we'll see, and the types of svaras that we talk about, are not without parallel in this area. So when we think about, so to speak, how we're trying to make the case, it's valuable to see what we can learn from these points. And it's just interesting as we talk about Nigo representing, whether it represents credibility, or whether it represents koach hataina, which seems to be a little bit of a difficult concept. We'll say a little bit more about it today. But the idea that it could be one or the other, or both, they're both relevant, they're all relevant to the arguments that we're making in Yom HaDin, so to speak. You know, on the one hand, our credibility is very important to us. We are declaring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we're going to change. And that's something that has to mean something. It has to have credibility to it. We discussed a little bit on Thursday when talking about Hilchos Tshuva, that the Rambam includes within the requirements of Tshuva. First of all, we noted the possibility that Kabbalah al-Ha'asid is perhaps the defining element of Tshuva, or at least of the mitzvah of Tshuva. And if that's the case, so then it emerges that the credibility is crucial, that the idea that we're saying something that is believable is a very crucial point. And the Rambam has this language that the tshuva is only effective kishiyoyid olav yodea talumos, that when he who is able to read the secret thoughts is able to testify upon us that what we're saying is true. So this is a very deep idea, and whatever is relevant to establishing our credibility in a genuine way is a part of that process. And it's not only true in terms of this idea of the establishment that you're not lying that you find in Migo, but even the koach hataina idea, the idea that there is something else available to you that's being used or not used. We find that both in terms of positives and negatives. And on the one hand, the Rambam saying also that real tshuva comes when ba'osa makom ba'osa isha, that genuine tshuva is not when somebody doesn't have the opportunity to sin anymore. So he says, we'll give it up. Okay, it's not so impressive. Now, as the Rambam describes, when somebody is very elderly and doesn't have the ability anymore, doesn't have the strength, doesn't have the opportunity to engage in avarice, and then, okay, so tshuva is something. It's not really everything that it could be. It's only really significant because the other options are available to you, and still you pick this one, so then that becomes a meaningful tainus, so to speak. And it's also interesting, I remember hearing an idea, I think I heard this possibly from Zaluginsky, I think he was quoting Eliashiv, I could be wrong about both those things, but essentially the point was that, if I remember the case correctly, that there was somebody who sang Kaddish, was looking for a minion, for a Ma'ariv, and the last Ma'ariv in his neighborhood was over, and he drove like an hour or something like that, or longer, to catch a Ma'ariv minion. So afterwards, he asked the Shaila, I think it was Rabbi Yashu, said, was I obligated to travel so far in order to catch this Ma'ariv? So his response was, no, you're not mechuyev to, but I'm mekane your ma'ariv. I'm jealous of your zchus here. And he went on to explain that it's an interesting notion if you think about it, that when you're judged for your mitzvos in general, so the schar mitzvah that you get is assessed for each mitzvah. It's assessed based on the one time that it was hardest for you to do this mitzvah. At the time when you went to the greatest lengths to perform this mitzvah, that's the standard by which every fulfillment of that mitzvah is assessed. So why should that be? Because what that indicates, if there was one time when you really had to push very hard in order to fulfill it, so it means that that's something you're willing to do, which is most of the time you don't have to. Most of the time it's easier, so you don't have to push yourself so hard. But when it's even harder, when it involves more pushing, involves going even further, so you're willing to do that, so then that shows you that this is something that's inherent in your preparedness for this mitzvah, so that'll be the standard every mitzvah that you get. So this is an important idea as well, especially here on a Sunday. So some people know that it's harder for people to be here on Sunday, there's all kinds of other things going on, but Baruch Hashem, many of us make the effort to come here anyway, and one could argue that that comes to the standard to define every day when you come to Seder, even when it's easier. When you come to Seder, even when it's easier to come to Seder, but because you're also willing when it's harder, that becomes the defining nature of even those days when it's easier, they're judged by that standard. And that's a tremendous chus to keep in mind and to strive for. So this notion that we find in Migo, that Migo seems to, on the one hand, go to credibility, on the other hand, goes to giving us a credit for that which we have access to, even when it's not necessarily in play right now, both the Kula and the Chumra, I think those have profound implications for the Hashkafa of Tshuva, for the Hashkafa of Din, not just Bin Adam L'Chaveru, but the Din between us and the Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's a powerful idea to keep in mind as we think about some of the points in the sugya. Okay, so with that, so to consider some of the parameters of Migo. So as we saw, we discussed last week a little bit more of the parallel, possibly identical, possibly different, possibly overlapping concept of Pesha Asar. So we'll assume that Migo is Din Daraisa. Pesha Asar, the Gemara quotes a pasuk, sounds like it is Daraisa. But Migo, we don't have an explicit discussion where the Gemara says, how do we know Migo? And quotes a pasuk. So how does that leave us? So most of the Rishonim seem to assume, and you've seen some of them, that Migo is a Daraisa. There are a handful of views in the Rishonim, which I didn't actually put on the list just because of availability. I tried to focus on the so many Makoros you could be looking at, so I tried to focus on the Makoros that you wouldn't have to spend too much time hunting down, but I'll give you more to look at if you'd like. So there are a handful of Rishonim which may indicate that Migo is Drabanan, which itself raises some questions, but it seems like the majority view is that Migo is Daraisa, and it kind of takes it for granted that it's Daraisa. So you could say it's Daraisa, so you could say, well, maybe it's identical with Pesha Asar, and Pesha Asar we saw has pasuk in Kisetse that was quoted as a source. But if that's not the case, so then you have to assume that, again, the idea is that Migo is a svara, and it's a svara that's so powerful that it's effective on the level of Daraisa, and that's where its applicability comes from, which again is itself a powerful idea, and we have to figure out exactly how to substantiate that svara, but that probably is the most likely possibility, and the most likely being that most of the Rishonim assume it is Daraisa, and as far as the source, it doesn't really seem like we have an explicit source other than the idea of it being connected to Pesha Aser. So the most likely possibility, adding those probabilities together, is that it's a Daraisa simply because of its inherent power to it, and that's a powerful thought. And again, we'll actually have to make reference a little bit later on that the first sugi in Bav Metzia is not our core sugi here, we're learning Exubis, but in some ways it's crucially relevant, and we'll have to give some more background to that. But when you learn the first sugi Bav Metzia also, so you see we're dealing with Dinim Daraisa, but most of the concepts that we talk about we don't really have Bakoros for as far as Psukim and Chumash telling us, Echloku, telling us, take this approach, take that approach. So it seems like we're dealing with very powerful svaras for the most part, and that's going to dictate, even on the level of Daraisa, how these principles are applied. Hi.
How is it that it can be such a powerful svara to be a Daraisa, but we're not exactly sure what the svara is?
Yeah, that's a fair question. We have to, it's a very fair question, but apparently that's not the only place that we find that, though. It's interesting, because we can talk about it a little bit from a Yom Kippur perspective, and then at the end, maybe we'll find some time before Yom Kippur to talk about an example that we find it at within Hilchos Yom Kippur. But it's clearly the case that we have instances where the Gemara attributes something to a svara, and yet, even if we know the words of that svara, we still don't necessarily know exactly how it applies, and that we need a lot of background and a lot of analysis to figure out what the svara is. So it means that the svara doesn't necessarily mean that it's obvious to us, and that it's an axiom as far in the sense of the sky is blue kind of svara, but that once you come to consider it from all its angles, you realize that it is an ironclad point. So that's an important point to call attention to. As far doesn't mean the inherent validity of the svara, the power of the svara does not rely on obviousness. It relies on its essential strength, and that strength is so present that works on the level of Daraisa, even though it's not necessarily obvious. It teaches us. Chazal tell us the svara, and then we work backwards to see how to understand it. But once that's the case, and then apparently there are some principles that are so unassailable in their logic that has a level of Daraisa to it. And I do want to go into some examples about that, maybe from some other sugyas, maybe in Kippur context. But for now, we'll take it like that. So, as we see, that the nature of the svara has two major categories to it. On the one hand, there is the possibility that you're simply more credible for choosing the less powerful or the less attractive claim, and that the assumption according to that is that you're telling the truth, and that's why you're credited with your position. So that you do find some of the Rishonim apparently alluding to that, or maybe most of the Rishonim really alluding to that. If this were a viable approach, you'd almost say it's a machlokas between the Rishonim and the Achronim, which we'll have to discuss a little bit, because that's normally not the way we like to break things down. We assume the Rishonim have more authority than the Achronim, so that's not going to be an acceptable conclusion. But it seems like from the Rishonim you find more references to truth, and in the Achronim you find the other possibilities explored a little bit more. But the idea that you're telling the truth because of the Migo, so it's also important, I think, just to dispel a misconception, it's also important to clarify what that means. That we have an expression, the Gemara has, malo l'shaker. Right? So basically, why would a person lie? That if the person could get off with a better lie, so then it seems to imply that he has no motive to lie this way, and therefore he should be believed. So the idea that somebody is believed when they have no motive to lie, I think it's important just in terms of also our day-to-day life, to clarify what that means and what it doesn't mean. Because sometimes, to go for a moment and say, "Hopeless Lashon Hara," so we think that we should believe somebody because they have no motive to lie. So there's a lot of difficulty with such a star, because first of all, we don't always know everybody's motives. People can have motives we don't know about, but even much more fundamentally, that not everybody who's honest is always telling you the complete truth. That people may not think they're lying, may not have any motive to lie, and are still wrong about something. They're saying something that is incorrect. So the idea, I think there's a lot of damage that could be done by the assumption that somebody's telling you something that's completely factually correct, just because you can't perceive in them any motive to, as they say, why would he be making this up? So if you can't think of any motive for this person to make it up, therefore everything he's telling you is 100% correct, it's a little bit of a dangerous way of thinking, because people make mistakes all the time, people misunderstand things all the time, and that's without even going into the fact that they can have motives that you don't know about. So when we talk about in this context of Malo Lashakir, we're really in a much more limited context. We're saying that when a person is putting forth his own positions, his own timings, and we're not talking here about subtleties, we're not talking about things that he saw, we're not talking about subjective assessments. We're talking about a person making their claim about what they did or didn't do, where they are the violent to know what happened. So then, do we work off the assumption that they are falsifying a claim? So to say, no, that he doesn't have a motive to falsify a claim when he could do that more effectively a different way. So I think it's important to keep the svara of Malo Lashakir within its proper limitations, and that it doesn't mean that anything that a person says is true if you can't think of a motive for them to lie. It means within this context of a person expressing the tainus that they are in control of, that when a person doesn't have a motivation to take this path over that path, within the rather limited realm of a handful of possible tainus, so then there is a credibility to the position that he's taking. But at the same time, as we saw, so there are many achronim who take the position that it's not about lying, and that it's about what they call for shorthand koach hataina. And for example, the Sefer Ataras Chachamim in Koshe Mishpat and Siman Chav writes in the Feirish that there is no real indication that a person is telling the truth just because he takes his less effective taina. And in fact, maybe he's gaming the system. Maybe he knows about how all this works. You know, the question always comes up that you might say that if a person knows about Hilchos Migos, so then Hilchos Migos should really fall apart because the person is taking a claim, maybe intentionally, because he knows that it's going to give him nemanus. Now, that's not a perfect question, because it depends on how you apply Hilchos Migo. If you say that Migo only works, we saw a little bit about this last week, Migo only works when the other claim that you could have used would have won 100%. So then a person doesn't really have a motive to exploit Migo, because he only has Migo if he's going to win anyway. Right? You can only exploit Migo if you wouldn't have 100% won with the other time. So it's a complex question whether that Migo could be abused. But this is how some of the Afronim are assuming that there isn't anything inherent in the usage of the weak claim that means you're telling the truth. It's powerful for a different reason. It's powerful because it gives you a time. It gives you the power of the better time that you're now using. You get that power anyway, and that's going to work in your favor. Okay, so far so good? Everybody with us?
The stronger claim argument, we've discussed it before, but it means not that you're telling the truth, but rather that's how to win an argument, meaning that's part of winning an argument.
So it's a good, I want to explain a little bit now what that means, because this version, this Koach HaTaina, there are many different versions of it, many different versions of the version, and many different takes on what this means, so I want to discuss that a little bit. And part of what we have to try to keep in mind is that all of the mechanisms that we talk about, it's not just in Choshen Mishpat, it's in other areas of Halacha also. When we talk about Migo, we talk about Rov, we talk about Chazaka, we talk about Bar Veshema, we talk about Muchzak, we talk about the other kinds of Chazaka. So in all of these areas, so one question that we have to ask is, just to speak broadly, Are we talking about, call it like this, are we talking about a birur, or are we talking about a hanhaga? What do I mean by those two terms? I don't want to take a stab at it. What do the two phrases mean?
Maybe it's like contribute to like a valid claim, or they just like lean you in one direction or the other.
Basically, but just to also say it a little bit further, is that at least broadly speaking, a birur would mean that something really tells you that it's true. You're taking this path because this halachic device, be it Rov, Chazaka, Migo, Baruch Hashem, or whatever it is indicating that this is the true case, this reflects reality. So we have ascertained that this is true because this mechanism is here. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that it's a hanhaga. Hanhaga would mean that we don't really at all know that this is true. All we know is that we don't know the truth. So therefore, we have to take a path. Right? In every area of life, we're going to have to follow some decision. I and I were talking before about cases where you have to make a decision, you don't have to make a decision. Right? This is one of the differences sometimes that comes up between halacha and hashkafa, in terms of broader philosophical hashkafa. Not in terms of your personal hashkafa zachayim, but in terms of more abstract hashkafa questions. So there's always a discussion about whether there is psak in these areas. Because in some areas of life, you need to make a decision. In some areas of life, you don't necessarily need to make a decision. So in many areas of practical existence, we're going to have to pick a path. Sometimes the path will be passive, sheval tasa kind of path, but we're going to have to go one way or another. So hanhaga will mean that I don't have any real indication that this is necessarily true, but it's the best I can do with. It's the best I have to work with. So let's just to pick one example. We talked about a rove, right? And let's say even not necessarily kosher mishpat, but let's say a rove in kashrus. Right? When you paskin that something is mutter to eat because a rove is going to indicate that that's the case. So what do we mean by that? Do we mean that the rove is telling us that this is really mutter? Right? So if you have 10 pieces of meat, 9 are kosher, 1 is not. So we say rove, you could have the meat that you find because it's got a rove for it. So does that mean that the rove tells you that it's really kosher? That that's the metzias, and they can now ascertain that this is the case? Or do we say that, no, it doesn't necessarily mean that. It means that the halacha allows you to follow certain rules when we don't know exactly what's going on.
First option would have like meat being like now becoming kosher, like changing.
Well, so that the first possibility wouldn't necessarily mean that. It could mean that that basically the laws of logic or the laws of probability are such that you are on firm ground thinking that this is really the case. That this is essentially the actual likelihood that this is really the kosher item. Is that what it means? Or does it mean that no, that the Torah says that you have the right, acharab mahatos, to follow the principle of rove, and rove allows you to believe, rove allows you to function as if this is true in the absence of any other information. Hi.
So if it's the latter, we should say to people, you shouldn't have it if it's part of the rove. Unless it's exigent circumstances.
Maybe not. I mean, that gets into other questions. It doesn't have to mean that. It could mean that it's still a principle of absolute practice, even if that's all it reflects. Now, or to give another example, let's say we talk about chazakah. If we talk about chezkas mamon, right? So we clearly put a lot of weight on chezkas mamon. But is that weight because we really think it's yours? You're holding it as true, you really think it's yours? And sometimes that's the case. Or are we saying that, listen, we're fully aware of the fact that people sometimes possess things that are not theirs. Right? It's certainly possible that somebody stole something, so now he's possessing it. Somebody could have borrowed it, so now he's possessing it. There's all kinds of ways in which somebody possesses something that's not theirs. So we can't say that possession equals the truth that you are the actual legal owner. But we can say that it makes you advantaged over anybody else. The other guy is not holding it, so if we have to pick one person in the world who's going to have the rights to this item, and we have no other way of deciding it, so it should go to the muhsak. So that means it's a legitimate way of acting, but it doesn't necessarily tell us anything about the reality. If a possibility is very strong that somebody else could have lent it to you or you could have stolen it, just we have no way of knowing who that could be or knowing that that's the case. So then the default goes to you. So these are not absolutes. You know, sometimes you'll have part of one and part of the other. But that's part of the issue here, that we have a birur possibility. Sometimes something is really there to clarify that this is really the case. And sometimes it's just an indication that this is how you can behave. The Torah allows that within its rules of behavior to function this way, regardless of whether it's true or not. So this Rabbi Akiva Eiger, for example, has a tshuva about Migo, where he writes that Migo is a birur and a halchacha, that essentially it is a process by which we can clarify that what the person is saying is true, while others clearly didn't take it that way. So if you say that it's a koach hatainus, so let's talk about that for a few minutes. So what could that mean to say that this koach hatainus idea, which again is very abstract. So what could the words mean? What could this be based on? So there are some who explain, like Rav Shimon Shkap. Rav Shimon Shkap used to be a rabbi in his yeshiva, and he's maybe more well known for his career in Tells in Europe. But the author of the Chiddush Rav Shimon and the Gemara, Chiddush Rav Shimon Budak Kohen, and also the author of the Shari Yosha. So Rav Shimon seemed to understand that Migo is similar to Biyado. Now, what does Biyado mean? That you sometimes find in Halakha, one of the principles of Nemanis is that a person is believed about something. If you find this in Halakhos Kashrus, you find this in other areas, that if a person had control over the situation, it was biyado to bring about the reality or not, so then he is believed for that area. So here, biyado doesn't necessarily mean that you are claiming that you did this thing. It seems to just mean that the fact that you have some control over it, that increases your influence in the situation. And now you have credibility, even though you're not, again, necessarily maintaining that you did it, but your level of access gives you an edge, gives you a higher stature as far as believability. So again, maybe that's what Migo is. Maybe is that Migo, you have access to a greater range of possibilities, and therefore you're more powerful in your claim than the other guy. Another idea, this is something that we discussed this morning, I said to explain what it meant. So there are those who suggest that it relates to Hapesh Aser in the reverse way that we discussed last week. So I'm going to explain what that means. So for example, Shmuel Rozovsky writes this. Shmuel Rozovsky was one of the most popular shirim in the world a few decades ago. He was a rabbi in Panovich. So his farm, his shiurim are published in many different maduras. Chiddush Reb Shmuel has many different versions of how the Reb Shmuel Torahs have been published. And there's also a sefer called Zichron Shmuel, which has some more isolated topics. So Reb Shmuel Rozovsky essentially connects it to Hapesh Asar in another way. We were discussing last week that Hapesh Asar is a subset of Migo. That since Ibo Yishasid, that since if you wanted to, you didn't have to say anything, so you're believed here. Essentially, it's a version of Migo. So now let's consider it from the other direction. Maybe Migo is a form of Pesh Asa, meaning what? That how did we understand last week the non-Migo version of Pesh Asa? Right, that basically that you are the authority here. You are the one who created the Isser by saying whatever you said. So therefore, we will believe you to define its parameters. You can say, okay, it's Isser to this degree and not more, because the whole Isser comes from you. So you could say that Migo works that way also, because you could say that since you had access to the different Taina, that would have kept you out of trouble completely. So the fact that you are taking this kaina, it's ki'ilu, you caused the problem. Not necessarily in the sense we were talking last week, where you started the whole conversation, like Rashi in our Dafin Subas, that the other person wasn't being tovei you. But even though you are on the hot seat, but still, since you had another option, you're causing your own problems by bringing it up this way. Right, let's give an example. Let's say amigo of somebody says you owe the money and you could have been kofar bakal, and instead you say parait. Right, it's one of the examples of amigo. Right, that you could have said I never borrowed money in the first place. That would it be his word against yours? It would be a kofar bakal. And instead you say I paid it back. So that's an example of amigo. Right, so you could understand that by saying that since I had the opportunity to escape this whole story by saying I didn't borrow in the first place. So by saying paraiti, it's like a pesh asar. It's like I caused myself the problem of discussing that I did borrow money from you. And now, therefore, I also have the credibility to say that I paid you back. So you understand the difference between that and what we said last week? Right? Last week we were discussing pesh asar as a detail of migo. Now we're considering the possibility that that migo is a detail of pesh asar. It both comes not from credibility, but from the fact that you caused your problems. And this is a different version, not that you caused your problems because you introduced the whole subject. You're on the hot seat, but still, if you could have run away, so you're deciding not to run away, means you created your problems, so we'll believe you. We'll believe you, therefore, that you borrowed the money in this example, and at the same time, that you paid it back. Tammy?
But we also say that this sermon makes more sense because we have more room for pasuk for Peshasa.
So they're all divorced, though. You know, maybe that tells us that that's the way Peshasa works, and maybe Migo is derived from that. Right? That maybe Peshasa, with the pasuk of Peshasa, teaches us that you can control the parameters of that which you introduce. And that this is now a division of that. That not just when you bring something up out of nowhere, but even when you're being accused. But still, if you have the opportunity to run away, it's a chiddush. It's not an obvious application of Peshasa, but it takes it to another level. And last week we thought Peshasa just means if you come out of nowhere and you bring up something, you say, I was married, but now I'm divorced, or you say that I married off my daughter to this guy specifically. The cases that we saw of Pesha Asar, so they were just cases where you brought up the whole story yourself. Where I bought this land from your family, it was theirs, but I bought it. So in those cases, you could have said, all right, Pesha Asar means you introduced the whole topic, so you're credible to define it. So here we're taking it to a different level and saying, not that you brought up the whole topic, but because you could have run away, you could have said, no, I'm kofar bakal, and you don't take that path, so your refusal to take the escape route now puts everything in your hands. It's as if you did bring up the whole story. So now the Pesh Asar credibility, Pesh Asar authority, let's use that word instead of credibility to distinguish them, that makes you the person who is credited with the story. So far, so good? All right, so there's another approach as well. There's the idea to say that you have access to all the tainas that you're not taking, which is a little bit different than what we're saying so far, that more abstract idea that koach hataina means that you are given the power of everything in your tool chest, which I think we phrased it last week, and just to explain it a little bit better, I should also point out, as Augustine writes in the Shir, if you ever look at the Svarim of the Strahls, that Augustine was one of the true Gaonim of the last generation, passed away in 1991. It's the Rashiv of Netzach Yisrael, which was in Yerushalayim in the last days of his life, is still there. The Yeshiva is still there. So his Shiurim have been published in volumes called Kontreise Shiurim. So he points out also, it's important to keep in mind as much as it complicates things, that Migo could be one or the other. Right? It doesn't have to necessarily be either a Birur or a Koach HaTaina. It could be both. It could be, depending on which kind of Migo we're talking about. So part of what we're seeing, we'll probably see more of tomorrow, there are all kinds of different Migos. So Migos don't necessarily all come from the same place. It could be that some Migos are a Birur, which could also account for the different Makoros, right, that use the different expressions. It could be that sometimes a Migo is a proof that you're telling the truth, and sometimes a Migo is a Koach HaTaina, and it depends. And when you have both together, let's say, so then that will be a Migo Tov. That will be a powerful Migo that may have more impact than other Migos. And basically, this is just enough to confuse and simplify things at the same time. That basically, we should be confused in the fact that we can't take any one mucker and say, this tells us everything. But that's also what makes things make more sense. It's the recognition that not every usage is going to be the same, and that not every Migo is equally powerful, because not every Migo is coming from the same methodology, and it could be a combination of both. So it's interesting. There is a Mahalach, which I wonder if, I'm not sure Achronim say this beferish, but I think you could say this based on the Rambam. For the Rambam case, I'll use my fancy schmancy Rambam app. But if you get a chance, this is on the Marmar Kamos, if you get a chance to see the Rambam Hilchos Tohen V'Nit and Paragvav Alach Aleph, saw that? Right, so what could you possibly say from that Rambam?
Well, one thing that's obvious, that if the person knows they can use Migo, that's valid, that's okay.
Right.
You tell the Chacham, don't worry, you can use Migo, don't be afraid to make a full claim.
Okay, that's an interesting point also. But if that's, that may or may not be the thrust of it. But I think there's something else that emerges from the Rambam which could be very relevant to understanding this whole Koach HaTaina idea. That, and this is something we're going to have to flesh out a little more. We'll see if we have time to do it tomorrow. That a lot of the svaras for Migo, especially the Koach HaTaina svaras, work better if we assume, like we said last week, that Migo is essentially a defensive tool. Right? That Migo is usually there to protect the Muchzak. Right? So if you work off that assumption, so many of the Svaras work better, and we'll discuss a little bit the substance of that assumption. But what if we were to say as follows? And remember last week we talked about how Dayanim have different jobs, that part of their job is to figure out who's telling the truth, to figure out the basic facts of the case. And then there's also some of these mechanisms which could function independently, and that the psak of a din Torah could be both. It could be a combination of trying to figure out that one side is lying, one side is telling the truth, and applying these principles either together with each other or balanced off against each other. So, for example, just to keep it simple, we talk about muchzak being the most powerful principle, hamotzim echaver, all of haraya. But at the same time, what if you had dayanim who were sure that the muchzak stole it from the other guy? Right? Let's say, for whatever reason, whether it's using the tricks that you read about in the Gedolim stories, like Reed Bird Flew, or whatever it is, right? But basically, if you have a dayanim who, on the one hand, Reuven versus Shimon, Reuven is the muchzak, and there's nothing else at play, so okay, motzei mechaver l'haraya, and he's a kofer akol that he owes anything to the other guy. But on the other hand, you are sure, for whatever reason, that the Beis Din has exposure to, that Reuven stole it from Shimon. Right? So then, presumably, that knowledge by itself will outweigh the chazaka. Their birur ha'emes, however they got to it, will presumably outweigh the cheskes mamon that Reuven has. And so there is some combination of these processes going on. That there is, on the one hand, the halachic principles, which are kind of a computer type, you program them in, and whatever it is. And there is the Birur HaEmes, role of the Dayanim, side by side. So the question we mentioned a few minutes ago about whether something is a Birur or a Hanhaga, so that's all a part of the mix. Some of the tools themselves go to the Birur HaEmes part of the equation, and some of them go to the Hanhaga part of the equation, and some of them are independent of either. So what if you say like this, which is especially, again, works best if you assume that Migo is a defensive tool. What if you say that really Beis Din is not paskening based on a taina? Right? A taina means, you have a claim that there are all these halachic categories, paraiti, lowly VC, I didn't pay it off, I didn't borrow in the first place, I paid half. There's halachic categories and claims you could make. Check off the box. What is my official claim? But we don't paskin based on your claim, really. We paskin based on all the different factors that are there. So the reality of being a muhsuk, for example, is really more what's going to lead to your winning than the specificity of your claim. And that, in essence, you could win without a claim. And let's think about that for a second. That if you don't claim anything, right, maybe you could have won anyway. And just to give it a comparison, let's say, for example, let's give the comparison of American civil law. Right, so if you're on trial, American criminal law, right? So you're on trial for committing a crime. And what's the principle? What's the fundamental principle in American criminal law?
Innocent
until proven guilty, right? So what is the significance of that? That means that if you don't say anything, but the prosecution fails to prove its case, you get off. Now you're exonerated because your chazaka is innocent. So it is the prosecution's job to prove otherwise. So if they prove you're guilty, so then you go to jail. But if they don't prove it, so then you stay out of jail, even if you say nothing, right? Which is why a defendant is not, well, it's not necessarily why, part of the defendant is not obligated to testify on their behalf one way or another. And you could have multiple claims of innocence. Right, because if the claim that court has a reasonable, the jury has a reasonable doubt, they don't know you did it, so it could be for reason A, B, or C. Right, so then it doesn't really matter which one it is, but they all result in the fact that your guilt is not proven. Could be this reason, could be that reason, could be another reason. So the reason you're getting off is not because of the reason that you're innocent, it's because that your guilt was not proven. Like you've ever heard the joke, a guy calls up somebody and says, "That pot that I lent you last week, it's broken." So the other guy says, "First of all, I never borrowed your pot. Second of all, when I returned it to you, it was in perfect shape. Third of all, it was broken when you lent it." Right? So clearly, no two of those things can be true at the same time. But it's a joke in terms of the logic of it, because obviously he's lying on something, you know, they're not all true. But at the same time, legally, that kind of works, right? Because if any of those things could be true, so then the fact is you can't prove that, yes, I took it and broke it. So too, essentially, the reason you're going to be exonerated is because the case isn't proven. And the default goes in your favor. And the real substance of it is secondary. Substance of why you say you're innocent. So, for the purposes of Dinei Mamonos, we have a similar principle, right? Amotzi mechaveo l'varaya is the Mamonos equivalent of the presumption of innocence. Right? It means that all other things being equal, unless I prove otherwise, you get to keep your money. So when Beis Din paskins that two people are fighting, Reuven and Shimon, each have their claims, and Reuven the Muchzuk ends up winning, it could be he won really because of his Muchzukos. And the taina is not the reason that he won. The fact that he said paraiti, the fact that he said lolovisi, the fact whatever he said, that's not the reason he won. The reason he won is because he's muhsuk. So then maybe he shouldn't have to say anything, right? So if somebody comes and says, "You owe me money," and the other guy could just say, "No, I don't. I'm not going to explain why, but I'm a muhsuk. Prove that I owe you the money." And it shouldn't necessarily be his obligation to explain why he doesn't owe the money. It's your obligation to prove why I do. And if you can't prove that I do, then I win. I shouldn't have to say anything. Right, do you possibly see some support for that in this Rambam that I'm talking about here? Alright, so what am I getting at in terms of this Rambam?
Yeah, right.
Sorry?
He does have to say something.
Right, but why?
Because Beis Din wants to hear all the details and then they decide based on.
Right, so what could you maybe read into the Rambam's words? Right? That maybe what the Rambam is getting at is that we need to know that maybe you misunderstand the halacha, maybe there's some detail here that's wrong. So because of that, you should explain why you think you're pater. And you should explain why you think you're chayiv. That's a part of the Beis Din process of trying to figure out the facts. But the fact that you're going to win or lose is going to boil down to your chazaka, or going to boil down to whatever else is at play. But the taina is not the reason that you won. It's not because you push this button instead of that button that works. That you're giving a taina is part of our process of collecting the facts. We need to know, maybe this happened, maybe that happened, maybe there's an inconsistency in the story, maybe you don't understand how everything works, you think you're pater and you're really not. So that's a part of our process. Right? But maybe Meikar Hadin, you could have won without that. Do you see how that could possibly be here in the words? Right? Balidin and Shabal Abazdin. Tana echad umani yeshli eitzel zeh shehob yisiv, o sheesh gadati yitzlo, o shegalz mimeni, o sheeshli yitzlo v'schar, v'chein kol ki yitzel v'zeh. Right, so one guy claims with some kind of specific claim that the other guy owes him money. V'heishiv hanitan, v'omer eini chayiv klum, and the other guy says, no, I don't owe you anything. O, eilecha v'yadi klum. O, sheker ata atoein. It just says something general, right? I don't owe you anything, you don't have anything by me, or you're lying. Right, that's a general type of claim. So says the Rambam, "Ein zu tshuva nechona." That's not the right way to do it. That's not the correct answer. Ella, it doesn't say it's not a valid taina. Right? It says it's not the right way to. It's not the procedurally correct way to do things. Ella omrim bez din lenitan hashev al taneso ufareisha tshuva kamoshe pirish zat taneso. Please respond to his claim and explain your answer the same way he explained what he said. V'amor, im levisa mimanu, im lo levisa, hifkir eitzlocha, lo hifkir, gazalto, lo gazalto, scharto, lo scharto, v'chein shar hatainis. So we tell him, no, it's not enough for you just to say you're off the hook. We want you to explain why you're off the hook. U'mepnei ma'im l'kabli v'chuvizu, why don't we accept his claim? Shema tohu b'daito v'yavol yishavol sheker. Right, maybe he's making a mistake and he's going to come to take a false shvua. Sherei efshe sholveu kamoshetan v'hichzer zachob l'vnoh l'ishto sh'nosl matonik neged achob v'yimiv b'daito sh'niftav v'nachob. That maybe the guy's really right, that the first guy does have a chob and the other guy misunderstood exactly what happened. So lefikach omru lo heich tomer eni chayu klum shema ta mischayiv nadim l'shali ve'ena ta yodeya elo hodala dayon in perish ha'dvarim ve'heim yodi ucha ma ta chayiv o ena ta chayiv ve'afilu hayachacham gadol omru lo ein locha hefzit shetashu vata neso ve'todienu keisad ena ta chayiv lo mepnei sholo hayu ha'dvarim e'ol mepnei sholo v'chazartalo shirei anodonin b'mitoich sheyachal omar b'chol magom. Right, so that's the phrase which Achronim do quote, that this seems to indicate that maybe the Rambam's understanding of Migo is a little more expansive. This Mitoch is really the Hebrew version of Migo. Right? Migo is Aramaic, so this Mitoch is essentially the Hebrew version of Migo. So essentially the Rambam, what you were referring to before, it sounds like he says, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not, it's basically, it doesn't matter whether you're gaming the system, don't worry about it, these are all options that are open to you. So it seems like what you could say in this Rambam is that we're going to decide whether you win anyway based on the facts of halacha. It's not about your timing. It's not because you push this button versus that button that's going to make you win. The halacha is not up to you to decide. Right? It's not up to the Balei Din to say, I'm chayiv or pater. It's up to the Beis Din to say so, and they're going to say so based on principles, which may involve simply the fact that you're the muhsin. So we want to know your specific taina, because that's a part of our process of figuring out all the different parts. But that's not what makes you win. So therefore, essentially, the fact that you have other comments open to you, that just all goes to the premises of the case, and therefore you win anyway. So that specific claim that you make is not the substance of what makes you win. And therefore, it doesn't matter that you took weak taina B versus strong taina A, You already won because of having a strong Tanya A as part of your foundation. Does that make sense? Does that help clarify anything a little bit? It could be that what the Rambam is saying is that, you see, he's essentially saying that you don't win because you chose this Tanya. Right? So if let's say I come to you and I say that, you know, if you focus on this relatively straightforward example, I say you owe me money because you borrowed money. And you say, yeah, I borrowed and I paid it back. Right? So that's a pretty classic Migo case. That you could have gotten off completely by saying you never borrowed the money in the first place. You'd be a kosher hakal. You would have gotten off completely. So since you didn't take that path and you took this path that acknowledged you did borrow the money, which is a slightly weaker taina, so you win also. So you're still, you have the Migo. So maybe we could say, what's going on there really? Are you really winning because of your claim of I borrowed it and paid it back? That's a believable claim, that's why you won? So maybe the point is no, you won because at the end of the day, he's asking for money, he has no proof, and you have the money, you're a chabachzak, so you win. That's the real reason you won. So we need to know the details. Well, what exactly happened here? He has a shtar, he seems to be a pretty credible guy. The idea that he said that he lent you money, it makes sense, he's a rich guy, you all of a sudden made a big investment, you know. It looks like that's true, so we need to get our facts here. So how did it happen that he claims that he lent you money and you're saying you don't owe him any money? Oh, okay, you're saying you paid him back? Okay, well, maybe that's true, maybe that's not true. We'll figure all that out. You know, we need to know the details of the case, the same way I'm going to ask you what time of day it was and how do you know him and all these things that are all part of our gathering information. And your claim that your pater maybe is based on a halachic mistake, is the Rambam saying. And maybe you don't understand the details. Maybe you think your pater for a reason that's not true. So I need to know the details of the bezdin. I need to understand how all these things happen. So the specific taina that you're making is part of the details. That's essentially what the Rambam seems to be saying here. Right, the specific taina that you say, the fact that you say that I paid back instead of saying I never borrowed it in the first place, that's not your winning card. That's a detail of the halacha that we need to know so we can figure out the facts. But your winning card really is your chazak. The chazak is really what does it. The fact that you have the money and he can't prove that you owe him the money.
Not
that necessarily you don't have to, but that even if you don't want to put too much emphasis on those words, right? You could say that you could be very medayik in those words and say that it's not a claim that the taina is wrong or the taina is ineffective. You know, it is a relatively mild way of saying it, so I think that is true. But even if you want to skip over those words and not overly be medayik in it, but still, what he goes on to say is that basically the taina is there so that you can explain the case. So that then you might be wrong in terms of the halachic facts, there might be all kinds of issues. So the bezdin needs to know how all these parts come together. That's a part of their process. But that's not why you won. So you won because the fact is, a muhsak can always say that I never had met you in the first place. The muhsak has the elements that get him off the hook completely. Right, so therefore, that's what makes you win. The power to get off the hook completely is what makes you win. So the fact that you chose not to taina that I was never involved in the first place doesn't matter. Your taina is not what makes or breaks the day. So maybe that's what koach ha-taina means, that your ability to escape is really the source of your winning this din Torah. And the specific taina is the detail. Right?
But you have to make a migo taina in order for it to work.
Well, what do you mean by making, you know, you have to
make a taina of that there would be other options.
Right, but it's the other options. It's not about the taina, it's the other options existing.
Right, but you have to make a specific taina in order for that reality.
Right, that's part of the process. Making the specific taina is a part of the Bezdin process. But your winning comes from the fact that you had another option. Now, Rav Asher Weiss, in his Shirim and Baba Basra, his Shirim in a couple places, he also has a more succinct presentation of this in the Sefer and Chumash in Parshas Kisese, where he has an essay about Pesha Asa. So he takes a different approach because he feels that you have to reconcile the view of the Rishonim, who all talk about Emes and Sheker, and the view of the Achronim who talk about Korach HaTayim. As we said before, it's not really an acceptable conclusion in terms of authority to say it's a machlokas, the Rishonim and the Achronim. You normally don't want to say things like that, so we have to figure out how to bring them all together. So he discussed a different approach, which is not what I think I'm saying here, even though he happens to reference this Rambam also. But what he essentially says is that it is a koach hataina, meaning that there is a stronger position to the guy who has the ego. So koach hataina means the points on his side are greater. Right? So why does Reuven win in this case? He wins because it's 6-4. We add up all our points, and Reuven has more points. So Migo means that he has more points to win over the other guy. Right? You recall, we saw last week, or it was the week before, a little bit more detail in our parak specifically, right? Trying to figure out between the husband and the wife. So we saw that Rishonim really seemed to be taking kind of a both mathematical and subjective perspective, right? Say, well, the wife has an ego and a cheskes aguf, and the husband has a cheskes mamon, and this and that. You put it all together, so this side wins. The bari v'shema, all the old is all part of the mix. So, how does ego work? Right. So basically, what Rav Asher Weiss is saying is, doesn't explain such detail, but what he's basically saying, how does ego work? Ego does not prove that you're telling the truth. Ego is one of the many tools that add up to a higher point score on your side. Right. Ego is one of the many assets that you have that make you richer than the other guy, and therefore you win. So in other words, that's what you mean by koach hataina. It simply means you are stronger than the other guy, and therefore you win. Not necessarily you're telling the truth. But why does it count for anything? Why is it an asset? It's an asset because it makes it more likely that you're telling the truth. You see how he's using both things at the same time? Right? The power of ego is rooted in the fact that it enhances your credibility. But it doesn't mean, at the end of the day, that you're definitely telling the truth. At the end of the day, it works because you have more points than the other guy. But why is this valuable at all? It's valuable because it relates to truth. So therefore, that kind of reconciles all the views. You're saying that the Rishonim who talk about truth, that's relevant. It's relevant that it's more likely to be true. But at the end of the day, its effectiveness for you is because it's simply one more point in your tool chest. And not because it means you're absolutely telling the truth. Yes, you could for sure be gaming the system and manipulating this, but this is valuable because it's relevant to truth. So I know who's up first, Morty.
Yeah. When the Rishonim were discussing Roger Weiss thinks that when the Rishonim were discussing it, this is what they meant?
Essentially, yeah. I think this is his effort to put everything in the same column and say, which again, you know, we do have a problem that we have to deal with the fact that it looks like you have the Machlokas Rishonim and the Achronim. Right? It looks like the Rishonim, for the most part, are all siding with the Emes Sheker kind of thing, and the Achronim are talking about other approaches. So it's hard for us to say that all the Achronim are at odds with all the Rishonim. So it's really necessary to try to find some way that they line up, essentially. And you could say, again, that every source is talking about something different. It's very hard to necessarily put everything in a straight line because, as we'll see probably more tomorrow, not all amigos are equal, not all circumstances are equal, and not all counterbalancing elements are equal, but if we assume that everything is in a straight line, so then it could be, yes, amigo is there because it's more likely to be true. That's why we put amigo in our toolbox in the first place. But the reason the guy with amigo wins is not because he's necessarily telling the truth, but having the amigo in his toolkit is something that's going to count for more.
The other way to interpret your is that it's objectively true.
Right. So, but that, as we see, is a little bit weak. You know,
right.
Not. I'll give you another example.
Okay. What other options do you have besides for explaining Emes and Sheker as?
They say it's machlokas. They say that those who point to Emes think that it's a birur, and those who say it's koach hataina are coming from another.
Okay. How else would you explain birur than just saying it's more likely you're telling the truth that it is the truth?
Yeah. But here, the difference between that and what we're saying here is that at the end of the day, we don't necessarily think the guy with the amigo is telling the truth because there's all kinds of other elements that could be at play. But the only reason the guy with an ego wins is because his points add up to more. Right, but why, or add to more stam. But why is Migo a tool at all? It's a tool because it's based on truth. I'll give you another example, another comparison. Right, so, and again, to look to American criminal law. Right, so we have a concept of a character witness. Right, so part of the testimony that the court may take if they're trying to figure out did this guy commit a crime or not. So we have some witnesses who'll say, well, I was there, I saw him do it, I was there, I saw somebody else do it. I saw him be somewhere else that day. You know, those are all about the case itself. Right? And then you have witnesses who come and say, oh, he didn't do it because I know him, he's an honest guy, he would never do something like this. That's a character witness. So a character witness, at the end of the day, the character witness could be wrong. Right? You could still think that he would never do this, and in fact, he did do this. Right? The character witness does not really go to the substance of this case. So what's the value of a character witness? It's debatable. Character witnesses don't necessarily count for that much as far as getting somebody exonerated or convicted. But they're a little bit of a point. And so in the context of everything else, when we're trying to figure out the whole story, the fact that there are so many people who think he's an honest guy, okay, so we'll put that into the tool chest. We'll put that into the points that we add up. The jury will say, okay, so we have two situations. One situation where we have no idea if this guy committed this crime. Another situation with the same facts, but there also are 10 people coming in and swearing he's an honest guy. So that'll be a part of our deliberation. So the 10 people, character witnesses by themselves, wouldn't really carry the day because they could be wrong. But they are adding a little bit to his defense. So they're about his honesty. Right? They are point. They're honesty points. But they don't really show that he's telling the truth here. So they're rooted in a discussion of honesty. But at the end of the day, their power is not in that they, their power is not in that they are establishing the truth. They contribute to a true likelihood on his side. Now, this affects a few other things. So I just want to mention one more point, then I'll set up the stage for tomorrow. And again, I think we'll just do one more day of this and then talk about Yantif on Tuesday morning, and then after Rosh Hashanah, I go into some other sugis.
Can I just ask about the thing you just said? So are we saying Migo is like character witnesses, or every other
Basically, I mean, it's not that much like, it's a little bit like character witnesses in a sense. It's a little bit of comparison. The value of the comparison is to say that it doesn't establish that you're for sure telling the truth here, but its power comes from honesty. Its power comes from, it's a point towards your honesty, even though it may not really dictate what happens to you. So, at the end of the day, can we say, oh, we have character witnesses, he's for sure innocent? No, he might be guilty, but we don't know if he's innocent or guilty. And he has honesty points for having the character witness. So too, Migo has honesty points. They establish he's less likely to be lying. We don't really know if he's lying here or not, but he has these honesty points in his bag, and it's 50-50, so the honesty points will push him over the edge. So part of what we'll have to discuss tomorrow a little bit more, and I just want to say a few more words about this, is all of these svaras, as we've been saying all along, work a lot better if you say that Migo is defensive, right? Which would basically mean that Migo does not work for a chazaka, for against a chazaka, that if you have a chazaka and I have a Migo, so I cannot use my Migo to take money away from you. That's called Migo Lahotzi Lo Amrina. That we don't say that you can use a Migo to be Motzi Mamun Minamosa. So if that's the position we take, Migo Lahotzi Lo Amrina, so then a lot of these svaras work better. That we say that Migo is only about defending yourself, it's not about an offensive attack against somebody else, and therefore it works based on this. But as you'll see maybe tomorrow, if you haven't seen yet, that it's not at all clear that that's the case. It is in Machlokas Rishona whether that's true or not. But that will certainly contribute to an understanding of what's going on. So part of what you should see tomorrow is, as you mentioned, when the Yeshiva was learning about Metzia 2 years ago, a lot of these things came up. So Ksubis is more directly about Migo than Bav Metzia is. But it happens to be that if you know the first Mishnah in Bav Metzia and the Rishonim there, so you'll see a lot about Migo through the course of that. So for tomorrow, you'll see on the Maamar Komoth already today, you'll see if, tomorrow, just look a little bit more, it's the first Mishnah in Bava Metzia, and there's a Tosfos over there, which is on the list, and just be familiar with that, because a lot of the Migo arguments are invoked in understanding that Mishnah. So we'll talk about that a little bit more tomorrow. And one of the things we'll have to figure out is we'll see there's a machlokas about this question of Migo Lahotzi, whether or not we say Migo Lahotzi, and we'll have to figure out how does that reflect. And one of the questions we'll also start with is this tool of Migo, how does it function? Does it function like a rove? Does it function like a fact? Does it function like a presumption? So with all that, that's also something we're going to have to try to assess. So let's just quickly review what we spoke about today. So we spoke a little bit about the hashgafic implications of Migo and Yom HaDin, which again I think are important to keep in mind at this point in time. But we spoke also about the fact that Migo is probably a deraisa, that's the way most of the Rishonim assume, acknowledging there are minority who don't say like that, but most seem to assume it's deraisa. And if it's deraisa, it doesn't seem like it has a mucker. It seems like it's a very powerful svar. The possibility of having a mucker is if we identify it together with Pesha Asar, so Pesha Asar in our character is a mucker. So either that's the mucker or there's no other mucker. It seems to be a very strong svar. So then we talked a little bit about the basic question about whether it's an evaluation of MS or it's Koach HaTaina. And we said the Rishonim, a lot of them talk about MS, and the Koach HaTaina is more in the Achronim, so it would sound like a machlokas to Rishonim and Achronim, which is not something we're really able to say, so we have to figure out how to work that out. Then we tried to explain a little bit, to flesh out what does the words Koach HaTaina mean. It's an abstract concept. So what does it mean practically? So we talked about Rav Shimon Shkop, who understood it as a function of Biyado. We talked about Rav Shmuel Rozovsky, who understood it as a function of Pesha Asar in the opposite way that we said before. Not that Pesha Asar is a type of Migo, but that Migo is a type of Pesha Asar. And that the authority, Svar of Pesha Asar, that you create the authority, so therefore you define the parameters. That's true here also, even though you didn't bring up the subject. But your refusal to take the escape clause means that you are essentially in control. You essentially set up the whole thing. And then we talked also about Rav Gustman's point about the difference between sometimes a birur, sometimes it's on haga, and when they're both together, that's a migo tov. We spoke about that a little bit. And then we spoke about the Rambam, that the Rambam Hilchos Tovim V'Nidin essentially seems to say that we ask you to explain your taina. Because of all these reasons, maybe you misunderstood the halacha, maybe it's got a factual implication, things like that. And what we basically wanted to suggest from that Rambam is that essentially the taina is not the substance of why you win or lose. The taina is just a part of the fact collecting of Beis Din, and you win or lose for other reasons. So therefore, what the Migo means is that these tainas that are available to you reflect the broader story of whether you win or lose. And the specific taina you pick is not what makes it happen, so therefore it doesn't matter that you use the weaker taina instead of the stronger taina. The stronger taina is still doing its work on behalf of you. And we noted Rav Asher Weiss's example, presentation, that essentially he maintains that essentially it is a koach taina, but the koach taina means that you are stronger because you have the Migo at your disposal. And the Migo is rooted in the fact that it's closer to MS, and that's why the Rishonim talk about it, and that's where we gave the character witness comparison. And then we noted that there's still a little bit more we have to say about how this operates, and that a lot of this works better if you maintain a Migo Lahotzi low Amrina position, that Migo is essentially a defensive tool and is not something that we use to be motzim and hamotzak, but we said this is also machlokas harishonim, and for tomorrow I encourage you to look a little bit at the first mission of Metzia and the Tosfos over there and the other rishonim to get a sense of some of the different possibilities that are out there about the limitations and the power of Migo, and God willing tomorrow we'll say a little bit more about that. All right, I thank you again for being here to be Mechazek the Sunday. The schus of the Sundays should be Omed for all the days when it's easier. And all of that should be Omed as a schus, not just for Asher Yishna Poyom, but also for Asher Neder Poyom. That should all be Zolcha from this schus to have a successful Yom HaDin. And I will see you tomorrow. Shkach. Did that come like that? Is that yours? Did you do that?